From Charter Hall and Banish, this is Sustainability Further. I'm your host, Lottie Diehl. You're listening to Sustainability Further, a podcast by Charter Hall, one of Australia's leading property groups. Charter Hall is focused on leveraging its large-scale platform to drive positive impacts and maximise value for its stakeholders. Delve into the fundamentals of carbon credits, understanding their role in mitigating carbon footprints and uncovering best practices for effective implementation. Rob Fowler from Partners in Performance shares valuable insights into the types of carbon credit projects that are available, the importance of transparency and credibility in reporting, and the emerging trends that are shaping the future of the carbon credits market. So whether you're a seasoned sustainability professional or you're just beginning your journey, this episode will offer you with some practical guidance and inspiration for leveraging carbon credits to drive positive environmental impact. Thank you so much for joining me today, Rob. I'm really excited to get into this episode. But first of all, I wanted to ask you, what does the word sustainability mean to you?
Thanks, Lottie. Thanks very much. I've been in this carbon, climate change, sustainability thing for about 22 years now. So it's been a long time. And sustainability to me is very much an ambition. It's a direction we want to go in. It's an approach to improving what we're doing right now, which is not at all sustainable. And so I feel like it's an ambition. We have quite a long way to go to realize success. And in my experience, it's a very contextual concept. So the context of where you're talking about, where you're standing, who you are, is all quite interesting about what is sustainability. It's quite different depending on the sector or the geography or even the area of concern, the time of year. But I think it's really interesting that it's not just about climate change. It's very much beyond climate and taking into a whole bunch of other key issues that we need to address.
I really love that answer, and I think that you're right. It is all about that journey. Right now, I don't think we really have a clear destination of where we're going or where we're headed because it's ever-evolving and it's ever-changing. So as you've just mentioned that you have worked for many, many years in so many different areas in the energy transition area of this of the business, and you've got a plethora of experience in sustainable finance, green bonds, carbon credits, and so much more. But what I'd really love for you to explain is, in your own words, what are carbon credits and why exactly are you using the term instead of using carbon offsets?
Yeah, this is a really interesting discussion, and it's in a state of flux a little bit at the moment. So way back when, in the mid to late 90s, a long time ago, there was a concept of climate finance. So how can richer countries help poorer countries get on with shifting and changing things so that climate change doesn't become a big problem? And that was the view back in the mid 90s. By the time we got to the end of the 1990s, we had this thing called the Kyoto Protocol, which was a UN agreement. And that sort of set up the situation which said, okay, advanced economy, say Switzerland, someone like that, if you can't reduce your emissions by X amount, which you're committing to under this agreement, then you can sponsor activity in other places. And if you can sponsor that in developing economies, that's got a win-win in terms of development assistance as well as climate outcomes. And so that's where this whole situation of shifting money around really was born at the international level, country to country. Then what we saw was an evolution of that around countries like Japan looking to get involved with providing finance for climate outcomes. And of course, measuring those outcomes became paramount. Is it money well spent was the question. And at that stage, we were looking for marginal change. If we could see a bit of energy efficiency over there, it was awesome. If we could see a windmill go up, oh my God. And so to shift money around into those outcomes was very hard to do. And it's changed a lot since then. But the concept of carbon credits are really trying to represent the outcomes of investing in climate solutions. So if I put in solar panels or wind turbines, or if I reduce the energy consumption of my vehicle or my systems, then that reduces the climate change journey we're on ever so slightly. And it usually improves the performance or energy costs and that sort of thing. But the challenge is that a marginal change like that, that's not really what we're after anymore. The time is up for that. So as the 2000s rolled on, people started to use carbon credits to say, look, I've emitted over here, can't do anything about it, or it's really expensive to do something about it. So I'm going to sponsor some sort of activity over there, and I'm going to use the carbon credits that they've created, which represents their outcomes, environmental outcomes. I'm going to use those to do one for one and compensate for my emissions over here, which I think are too hard to abate. So it's become this sort of journey where a carbon credit representing this outcome and the financing of it has now been used as an offset to sort of compensate for emissions over there to create a neutral outcome. Again, that's a marginal change. It's a pretty small marginal change. What we really need now in 2024 is much more transformational change. And that's really what we're seeking at the moment. You know, a few million dollars going to carbon credits is great, but we need the big money and the big value opportunities to be realized so that we can see massive change rather than little changes at the small scale.
No, I think that's a really great point, because I love the way that you've just explained that, because I think carbon credits are being used increasingly by companies, but it's really difficult for people to understand. They're kind of like, but hang on, weren't we saying offsets? But now we're saying credits. So thank you so much for that explanation. So aside from credits, your work at Partners in Performance also involves helping clients reduce their emissions and establish a pathway to low carbon future. So I would love to know, acknowledging that every organization is different, but what are some of the first things that you look for to enable and to help turn these sustainability goals into also positive economic outcomes?
Yeah, it's an interesting challenge right now, and there's more and more interest in this, which is great. After 20 years in this game, it's exciting for me. The work we do at Partners in Performance is a little bit different to, I suppose, the traditional sort of consulting firm. We don't sort of sit back and write a report and hand it over and say bye-bye. We actually work inside our client operations. Our mainstream of business is continuous improvement. So performance improvement, if you've got a big industrial operation, you've got a mining operation or some other thing that has high capital intensity, then you want to get the most out of that, we come in and help the people running it to, you know, get better and achieve the performance targets they need. We also help with capital programs that are sort of running off the rails a bit and need a bit of a fix up. So our work is very much inside our clients. And what we find is that most of the ideas around improving performance or reducing emissions or being more sustainable, you know, reduced water consumption or less pollution, most of those ideas are already sort of popping up inside the people who work there every day. A lot of our work is to bring those ideas out and really run them through a commercial lens, understand what are the synergies, what are the implications, how valuable is that opportunity, and also how easy is it to implement. So we use a value ease framework to assess these things. And so we often find that if we bring the ideas out from where our client has already been thinking, and then we bring our ideas to the table from doing a lot of these, and we've done about 300 bottom-up decarbonisation plans for these big industrial sites and facilities. So we're deep inside that journey, and that's over the last 3 years. So we're banging these things out and updating them now as people realize that, okay, ambitious targets or less ambitious targets need to be adjusted, refined. So yes, very interesting work. And we often find that bringing those two things together, the internal ideas as well as what we can bring to the table from our experience, and then rolling it through. We're helping entities go all the way from strategy all the way through to engaging equipment manufacturers and contractors to get these things actually built and financed, which is great. We're very excited about that sort of whole experience that we're helping people go through.
No, it's very exciting. And I feel like 300 in the last couple of years, no wonder you needed a break over the weekend. So with all of this, kind of, I'm just trying to zoom out a little bit and think about the broader corporate sustainability strategies and kind of how you fit into this strategy, but also how you also incorporate carbon credits into these initiatives. Do you have any kind of top level examples that you could share with us?
Absolutely, yeah. So a lot of our clients come to us with a bit of a blank page. They haven't really addressed this issue before. They've been doing cost savings and other efficiency things. That's sort of normal course of business when you're trying to make a profit. But going this transformational lens is quite unusual for them. So us coming in as a bit of a catalyst in that, what we often find is that we can get very steep reductions in carbon emissions or greenhouse gas emissions, and usually they're value creating opportunities. But then you've got to have that ease overlay. How easy is it to realize that value? So very important to look both ways. We're very practical in what we recommend and how we roll through these things. And we're very keen to provide business cases that can go straight to the board and be assessed and understood very clearly. So a lot of it is about communicating the potential outcomes and then what can be further explained externally for these clients. One of the challenges they face is that a lot of the emissions in their control, so the things that they emit directly, so burning fuels and that sort of thing, or driving vehicles, there's a pathway there, but it's not cheap. It's not immediately actionable. There's also opportunities to reduce the amount of emissions you use from the grid. And in Victoria, that's quite a high intensity grid. So yeah, behind the meter renewables is a really interesting phrase that we're hearing a lot these days, where you take your assets and generate your own power, get some batteries. Sweet. So yeah, there's an interesting opportunity here for people to come together and bring those opportunities to the front. But at the end of the day, they've probably got emissions they can't control or they can't reduce. And that's where investing in climate solutions outside of your own value chain is a really important concept that a lot of companies are really latching onto. And that beyond value chain sort of action is something that's also gaining some traction in the international community, who are looking at how the integrity of these things and the statements being made can be supported with real world outcomes.
That was going to be my next question, because I'm learning so much and I'm loving everything that you're saying. Behind the meter renewables, did I get that right? It all sounds so interesting. But my next question was the role of transparency and credibility, because if you're making all of these claims, you're making all of these changes, you're trying all of these new things, how can a company ensure that there is integrity behind all of these projects? Because I'm pretty much just like, sign me up to everything. It all sounds great.
Yeah, it's very interesting. There's lots of funky phrases going around at the moment. We've had the world of carbon neutral, which has been a very popular concept and involves the use of carbon credits to offset emissions. We've got net zero, which is a slightly different concept, trying to get more action internally before you use offsets. And now we're seeing this beyond value chain concept, which is being thrown around by the integrity police around the world on these sorts of things. But it's interesting, when I first started in this, none of this existed, yeah? When I first started in this game, this is all very unknown and had to be built. These days, there's a lot of, I suppose, skepticism about these sorts of things. You know, people say carbon credits aren't worth anything, they don't represent anything. And, you know, that's completely the challenge, is that these things are trying to estimate the outcomes from something that have changed on the ground. And often that's quite tricky to do in a reliable and repeatable way. But the real challenge here is to try and have a credible story. And what we're seeing now is this concept of a transition plan. So how is a company going to transition from its current sort of approach and business as usual with supply chains and operations? How is it going to transition to a low carbon or more sustainable future? And that could be water, it could be pollution, it could be beyond climate change, but how are they transitioning towards that? And that's becoming a really interesting artifact. And you throw that into the mix that we're having now, mandatory reporting here in Australia, that's a really interesting challenge for a lot of companies, because that's a forward-looking statement and really uncertain about what's going to change and how you're going to change and how the market's going to change. And so we're seeing a lot of focus on agile transition plans. And that's where transparency really comes in. Because if you go to the market and say, we're going to reduce emissions by 30% by 2030, that sounds awesome. And then you run the numbers bottom up and you realize that 30%, well, maybe by 2032, maybe we'll get to 27% by 2030. And so there's a sort of uncertainty there. Now, if you go to the market and say, that's my promise, you want to be able to come back to the market a year later when the numbers have changed and supply chains have shifted and another war somewhere. And, you know, you have to be able to update that. So that agility with these forward-looking statements is a really interesting challenge for a lot of corporates, because starting in July, companies are going to have to track their information so that they can report this publicly over time. And that cycle is beginning. So, you know, people are starting to have to track scope one emissions, their direct emissions, scope two in terms of the energy they buy. And then all these supply chain emissions, which are really hard to get your head around and get numbers around. So, yeah, and then they then have to add in some scenario analysis, which is a really uncertain area at the moment, and a transition plan. And these things all have to be signed off by the board. The same sort of intensity as financial statements. So a really interesting shift is coming for a lot of the boards and senior management, and therefore the reliability of the information that's flowing through to those reports.
No, it's scary. Really
sorry,
it's
didn't mean
really
to be scary,
scary
at the end here.
No, I'm a bit more scared now, but I have more questions, because if you're going to, well, more organizations are going to the board with these agile transition plans rather than a set forecast or a set, we're going to hit X by 2030 or by 2032, as you just said, it's kind of like we're shifting our conversation and our languages, and the more people that are going there kind of saying we need to be flexible and we need to be agile. But how does that go in terms of making claims, making statements to shareholders, when you're kind of going, well, it's agile, and people can then go, well, you can shift and move that depending
so
on
so how much
happens.
Can we trust what you're going to do?
Exactly.
A really interesting tension there, a really interesting tension. And we often find that the more sophisticated players here will have two versions of their plan. One is a public external version, which is usually summary, sort of one step back from the detail, but reassuring, if that makes sense. And then they'll have a more detailed plan that has the bottom-up reality of the studies they've done or the engineering reality or the costs and value potential. And that's the sort of thing they'll share with a much smaller group of stakeholders. It might be investors, it might be fund partners, it might be government regulators, that sort of thing. But there's two levels of detail. And that more detailed thing is where you can start to build trust, if that makes sense. So you can say, well, here's two scenarios in terms of my mining equipment. I can either wait for electrification, because I don't make the equipment, I just buy it and use it. So I can wait for someone to make an electric version and meanwhile build as much renewables so I can get the electrons I need every day. Or I can look at renewable diesel and I don't have to change any of my equipment. I don't have to wait for electric vehicles. I can just throw that in the tank, even get the warranties on my engines. So how much am I willing to pay for renewable diesel compared to waiting for electric equipment? It's a something you can't predict, if that makes sense. You know, in the US, we've seen renewable diesel and other biogas come out of the woodwork because there's a real stimulus for it. There's a real price for it. And so that's starting to happen. In the past, fossil fuels have always been cheaper. And so now we see that there's a shift in that economics and the desires and the sort of, I suppose, the total cost of ownership that's the equivalent, if that makes sense. So yeah, really interesting times and lots of uncertainty, which again makes it harder to lay out a five-year plan.
Totally. And I think it's one of those things that, because as you first mentioned, sustainability is a journey. And I think coming back to those plans and reiterating them and changing them and shifting them depending on what is happening in the market is something that should be business as usual and should be part of those kind of reviews that happen and check in, like you do with your financials, and you kind of go, okay, well, we're not on target, or we were on target and then X happened that was completely out of our control.
I think that's the transparency that we're going to start to see inside companies, because there's now more gravity on at the end number. Has it gone up? Has it gone down? Why? Those questions are always asked about financials. And so now we're going to see those around more sustainability metrics, whether that's water use or pollution metrics or, you know, non-compliance with things. So it's going to be very interesting. And we now have a compliance mechanism in Australia to drive the purchasing of these carbon credits. So that's a new dynamic as well. A lot of the carbon neutral and offsetting has always been voluntary. You know, I'm going to make a commitment because I think it'll improve my branding or differentiation in the market. But now it's mandatory for big emitters to buy these things and throw them to the government every year. Buy some more, throw them in. Buy some more, throw them in. There's a lot of money that's going to change hands in the coming years.
In today's discussion, we've spoken a lot about the big players and what they're doing to shift the needle and to invest in carbon credits. But for the smaller players out there, what would be your advice?
We've talked about the sort of big end of town. You know, millions of dollars and lots of emissions and all these sorts of things. The reality is that everyone needs to have a crack at this. But again, not everyone has the resources or the time to figure it all out and put the money aside. So I sort of feel like there's got to be a practical layer here. We can't expect everyone to report everything, but we can expect some of the bigger players to actually use their muscle to shift and transform.
No, it's an interesting time that we're at the moment. And I think, as you've mentioned throughout this episode, it is changing and evolving. So on that, I would love to know, you've already mentioned a couple of emerging trends, but I'd love to hear exactly, if you were to look into that mirror ball, into that glass fortune teller's ball and tell us what you foresee in the carbon credit market, but also if you can help provide companies who are listening to this with some information how they could potentially stay ahead of the curve in leveraging these carbon credits? Would love to hear what you see.
Yeah, absolutely. I think people get lost in the detail very quickly around these carbon credits, and whether it's legitimate or high integrity or quality is a very tricky word. What is a quality credit? I think that the reality is that people are shifting their thinking a bit from sort of compensating for emissions that are too expensive to abate to focusing more internally on what they can do to change things, how long it's going to take, where's the investment. And the most recent concept that's being put out is this beyond value chain mitigation. And that's a concept that's being put out by some old friends of mine at the Gold Standard Foundation, as well as other groups who are trying to improve how these things all work and how we shift from marginal change to transformational change. That's really it, going back to that first discussion. So the idea here is you put an internal carbon price on all your stuff, all your things you're doing and your investments, and instead of having a shadow carbon price, which a lot of companies have done, you make it a real carbon price. And you put that money into a central bucket, and then you spend that money on climate solutions that are outside of your value chain. A little bit different.
Interesting. Yes,
yeah,
it is.
So it's about the funding, how much you're spending. And then there's some sort of equivalence about, you know, okay, well, if you've just bought offsets, how much would that be? Or how big are your emissions you can't abate? So there's a sort of quantification part to it, but it's not the focus. It's more about what are the investments you're making? Okay, what is that climate solution? Who's it impacting? How is it changing things? So I think the stories behind these carbon credits are going to become more important. And looking not so much at the carbon accounting and carbon, you know, numbers, but looking at the climate solution. What has actually been done to change things so that the climate's better off after this intervention? That's really it.
So we're looking more at kind of through a social sustainability lens rather than an economic sustainability lens.
Just not just pure carbon, but what are the other outcomes here? I mean, you look at some of the investments that have been made in climate solutions in the north of Australia and the way that savannah burning practices have come back to that countryside. Over with the carbon revenue that's been flowing in. It's remarkable. That countryside is now much better managed. And last year, when there were huge fires in central Australia, in the northwest, the areas that had been burnt, but with, you know, support from those climate solution funding through carbon credits, those areas didn't burn hot. The forests weren't destroyed. The place wasn't trashed. But the areas which didn't have that activity underway, because no one else is going to fund it, if the carbon credits weren't there and being, you know, valued, the areas that weren't burnt in anticipation just got nailed. Hot fires going all through them. It's going to take decades for those forests to recover. So really, really interesting real-world outcomes that you can point to. And I think that's a really interesting step for people, stepping back from the number of tons and that sort of thing to more about what's the change that's happened here.
Yeah, what's your influence that you've been able to have because of this? I think it's really exciting, and it's also more meaningful as well to be able to see that direct impact in a project rather than just looking at a number on a screen.
That's right. I mean, we have a client who used to spend about $30 million on international offsets so they could have one line in their sustainability report. Now they've realized that $30 million could have an impressive impact on various things much more within their field of view rather than the, you know, renewables or methane overseas. So, yeah, interesting opportunities to change things much closer to home, I suppose, but also have quite a big impact just using that money beyond this offsetting stuff. If you can invest in a climate solution that doesn't actually create credits, that's okay. You can probably quantify the outcome to a pretty good degree. You don't have to go through all the rigmarole of creating these things and settling them, having a license and blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, if you can just realize climate solutions and outcomes with your own approach and investments, that's pretty good.
No, I think it's great, and it comes back to that switching from marginal change to looking to transformational change, which I think is my biggest takeaway from this episode. So I just wanted to say a huge thank you for coming on today, and I'm sure that everybody listening has learnt so much. This conversation is part of Charter Hall and Banisher's podcast series, Sustainability Further. This series has been designed to inspire businesses and people to take action on environmental and social issues affecting our society. Sustainability Further is produced by Banish. Charter Hall's purpose is to create better futures by bringing aspirations to life.